Hey everyone, glad to see you made it. We know how to handle the snow in the Midwest. We wish all those across the country were not in the condition they're in, but we're ready to proceed. And we'll proceed with the first case, Sherman versus Koch, 09-14-55. And are you ready to proceed, Miss? Is it Ms. or Miss Murphy?
Mrs.
Mrs. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Rachel Murphy, Assistant Illinois Attorney General, appearing on behalf of Dr. Koch. The District Court's judgment invalidating Section 1 of the Silent Reflection and Student Prayer Act should be reversed because the law has the legitimate secular purpose of calming students as they begin their school day, does not have the inevitable effect of endorsing silent prayer, and is clear enough that the students can reasonably understand what is required of them. Because the students have brought a facial challenge, they have to show that the law is unconstitutional in every conceivable application. As the Supreme Court has cautioned, a law should not be invalidated based on factual assumptions about how it might be implemented. But here, the students' argument rests on just such speculation. They have not met their heavy burden of proving that there are no circumstances under which Section 1 would be valid. To start, the students have not demonstrated that Section 1 has the actual purpose or inevitable effect of endorsing religion. As other courts have held with respect to similar laws, the text and the legislative history of Section 1 demonstrate a legitimate secular purpose that meets the first prong of the Lemon Test.
If the purpose of the law is truly secular, why mention prayer in Section 1 at all, especially when Section 5 makes it really clear that prayer is a protected activity?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason that prayer is mentioned in Section 1 is to rebut any possible negative connotation that might be implied from the preceding phrase, which says that the moment shall not be conducted as a religious exercise. The sentence then goes on to say that it shall be an opportunity for silent prayer, so that if anyone were confused by being told this shall not be conducted as a religious exercise, the mentioning of an example that you may silently pray would rebut or assuage any concern that silent prayer by the students themselves is somehow forbidden. So that explains why the legislature included silent prayer as one of the examples, in addition to reflection on the day's activities. And in fact, as the legislature said, the students may reflect on whatever they wish. That was explicitly stated during the debates.
Right, but here they're given two alternatives, prayer or silent reflection. Some of the other state statutes that have been cited by your opponent give more examples. They give the catch-all alternative. Why wasn't that sufficient?
Oh, I'm sorry, why wasn't what sufficient?
Well, I'm just saying that what the or here gave them really two choices. When you look at those other statutes, it was clear they were given a number of choices, or that catch-all phrase was in there.
Yes, Your Honor. The statute does provide two examples, but it doesn't limit students to those two options. It does expressly state that it's an opportunity for silent prayer or silent reflection on the activities of the day, but it doesn't say that the students are limited to only those two examples of thoughts. And in fact, it would be absurd for the legislature to command teachers to police what children are thinking about during this time period. The legislative history also establishes that the legislatures had no intent of limiting students to simply prayer or reflection on the anticipated activities of the day.
Statutes in Texas, for example, it says, as a student chooses, reflect, pray, meditate, or engage in any other silent activity. And so
yes,
that makes it abundantly clear that there are a number of choices, whereas this statute is really focused on these two alternatives.
I disagree, Your Honor. The statute is not focused on the two alternatives. Although the legislature could have drafted it in a different manner, the fact that they chose to provide as options silent prayer or silent reflection on the day's activities doesn't mean that they were intending to limit the students. The only command in the statute is that the teachers shall observe a brief period of silence with the participation of all the assembled students. That's the only command. It does not say that you must use this time for prayer, or you must only use this time for prayer or reflection on the day's activities. It simply says there shall be a brief period of silence.
Is that essentially the secular purpose, is the silence? Is that the what the purpose is, get the kids to settle down, be quiet, and do whatever? Now, and I know in the Texas case, I guess they said the Pledge of Allegiance first and then went to that, what Judge Williams just recited. But in this goes back to the original one. I think the main change was going from may to shall, sometime along the line. But it goes back to, I guess, in 1969. And even then, this emphasized the period shall not be conducted as a religious exercise, which
yes.
seems to be an accommodation or trying to follow the law, as was set out then. And then, as you said here, it's opportunity for silent prayer to distinguish it from, I guess, one phrase and the other. Is that what this is about? Because I think when any time prayer is mentioned, it raises a red flag for some, and that this is an effort. I know to legislatures have a habit of trying to do the right thing without just the Wallace case, of course, was an admitted sham, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor. The way that you put it is exactly right. The intention of the legislature, as evidenced in the plain language of the statute, was not to make this a religious exercise. And they expressly stated that since 1969, it has always said that. The next phrase then, saying that it may be an opportunity, it shall be an opportunity for silent prayer, is simply to ensure that the students understand and the teachers understand that even though this isn't to be conducted as a religious exercise, that students have the right to silently pray during this time.
Would there be some caution or concern then that maybe the students wouldn't think that moment of silence would be available because it's in school?
That they wouldn't, that they would believe they could not pray because it is in school. And at the time that the statute was originally passed, there have been recent Supreme Court cases striking down school prayer, and it would have been reasonable for a student to think, well, I can't pray in school at all. And so this statute clarifies for the student that, yes, you may, during this silent time, that is something that is permissible.
And does your position, Mrs. Murphy, does it depend at all on the legislative history, or are you relying on the plain wording of the statute entirely?
The plain wording of the statute is enough, Your Honor. Of course, the cases, and especially the Wallace case, have looked as well at the legislative history, and so that's why we've looked to that as well. But the statute is plain on its face. It provides for a moment of silence, a brief period of silence, and that's all the court needs to find that there's a secular purpose here.
And is one of the reasons you're not relying on the legislative history the statement that the bill's chief Senate sponsor said, which was, here in the General Assembly, we open every day with a prayer and Pledge of Allegiance. I don't get a choice about that. I don't see why students should have a choice. And in the House, when the bill was up for a vote, some of the legislators sang a song on the House floor about hello school prayer. I mean,
I wonder if that was before or after dinner.
It's time to vote on you again in our schoolhouse. Without warning, you seek a moment in the morning. So what are we to make of that?
I'll address both of those points, Your Honor. The statement by the sponsor, by Senator Lightford, to the press is best seen as explaining why the law was amended in 2007 to make it mandatory. What she's talking about is choice. her choice, the student's choice. Prior to 2007, the statute was permissive. Her concern and the reason that she brought the 2007 amendment to the floor was that it be made mandatory so that all students would have an opportunity to reflect on, in her words, whatever they wish during this moment, during this period of silence. So it wasn't intended, and she never stated during the debates that her intent was that the students pray. Her intent was that all of the students have an opportunity, because in some classrooms in the same school, teachers were observing a moment of silence, and in others they were not. And so that explains her statement. It was not intended to say the students, we have to pray so the students should. It was intended to say, we don't have a choice about how we begin our day. We don't think the students should have a choice either. We want this to be mandatory for everybody.
Now, the mandatory, obviously, the mandatory of a period of silence, as well as what else. So the only, because that may observe, and then it starts with a brief period of silence. It has changed to shall appear a brief period of silence.
Yes, Your Honor, correct. So the mandatory aspect is the period of silence. That is all that was changed, and that is all that was intended to be changed. Now, there were statements by legislators, as Your Honor pointed out, about this, is this about prayer? But they didn't say, our intent is that we want to return prayers to school, the way the legislators did in Wallace and in the May case, where the court found there were no secular purposes for the statute. Some legislators stated that they believed other legislators were voting for this because of prayer. But the fact that that was floating around doesn't mean that that was the primary purpose of the statute. And there is no evidence in the legislative record to question the plain statements by the sponsors and by other legislators that they did not intend to make this about prayer.
Public prayer in schools.
About, yes, a collective prayer.
Is your point is it not, that there is a, this legislature can protect the right of private prayer in school?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And that speaks to Section 5. Section 5 was an attempt by the legislature to navigate between students' free exercise rights and Establishment Clause rights.
Now, that was that Section 5, because I know that your opponents tried to couple them together, but that seems to have been a later statute. It would be under the same heading, and because the title then includes both. But am I correct in understanding that this was, again, a message that in school there are opportunities where you can pray as long as it's not in bothering other people? For instance, someone says grace before eating lunch.
Yes.
To themselves, they can silent, but let them know that school is just not off limits for any type of prayer.
Is that, yes.
And they're not connected. It's your position that they are separately identified. It just happens to be under the same, I guess, whatever they call it when legislative stuff. I've been away from that a long time. It's the common title, so it goes into that section as opposed to somewhere else.
Yes, Your Honor. And as you pointed out, Section 5 was enacted, in fact, decades after the original Section 1. And so to read into Section 5 some intent as to Section 1 is not a persuasive way to look at legislative intent. The legislature in 2002 can't speak to what the legislature in 1969 or even in 2007 was intending with respect to Section 1, which has a separate secular purpose of providing for a calming transitional moment as students start their day.
But the existence of Section 5 in 2002, which clearly lays out the right of the student, clearly lays it out. You know, why is it necessary, or why was it necessary to do it in the 2007 Act? I'm still stuck on that, why it's necessary when, as you say, it clearly laid out the rights of the student, made it clear what they could do. I mean, why was prayer needed why was the word even needed in the new section?
Well, but prayer has always been in Section 1. So there's always been a statement that silent prayer
I mean the alternatives, because what we had before was we had a permissive situation. It was may,
yes.
And now it's turned to shall.
But that doesn't change anything about the second sentence in the statute. That simply changes the fact that the same period that has been allowed for all these years is now mandatory. It doesn't change anything about the nature of that period itself. And in adding Section 5, even when the legislature then looked at Section 1 again in 2007, there still is a need to clarify that the phrase that this shall not be conducted as a religious exercise doesn't mean that students cannot silently pray. Section 5 doesn't itself address the period of silence. It simply is laying out what students' rights are generally. Now, a student still could think, that's great, I know generally that I may pray during school, but this particular moment has said we can't conduct that as a religious exercise. So I'm now confused. And by leaving prayer in, the legislature again has made sure that any concerns about whether a student may silently pray during this time are assuaged.
Was this an attempt at Section 5 to just kind of be a legislative summation of what the case law had developed?
That is my understanding, Your Honor. The purpose for Section 5, there's not a lot of debate on Section 5. What the sponsor said is that the legislators worked with a number of groups, including the ACLU, to put language into place that would protect both free exercise and Establishment Clause rights and clarify what students' rights are in school.
It seemed to be, I didn't study all the legislative history and whatever, but it seems that it was pretty much discussed independently and with no reference to Section 1.
Correct. That is correct. There was no reference whatsoever to the period of silence during debates in 2002. The language of the statute also does not...
So let me just make sure on this Section 5. So you're saying basically Section 5 is irrelevant.
It is not relevant to the intent of Section 1. That's right, Your Honor.
Well, Section 1 is what's being challenged, isn't it?
Correct. And Section 5 is not being challenged. It was not challenged in the complaint. The district court did not hold Section 5 unconstitutional.
We do have to read the statute as a whole.
In context, yes. To the extent that it might be relevant in context, again, it evidences a different intent than that for Section 1, which, as the judge has noted, was about navigating between free exercise and Establishment Clause.
But that's also inherent, as my sister indicated, that's also inherent in Section 1, is it not?
In the sense that there's there was a desire to clarify that the phrase, this shall not be conducted as a religious exercise, doesn't mean students cannot
so
silently
pray. So
there's
no tension, in your view, between 1 and 5?
No, Your Honor.
Now, one of the reasons that you said this moment of silence is important is because it calms the students, and you said that some teachers were using it and others weren't. If this, you know, have there been studies or evidence that this moment of silence does help calm things?
There was the affidavit that we submitted from Dr. Hansen, which she opined that having a calming moment at the beginning of the school day does serve legitimate pedagogical interests.
Do we need stuff?
Go ahead. So, I mean, I understand that was her affidavit, but I wondered if there had been any kind of study.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Do we need them?
No, Your Honor. All that matters is that the legislature sincerely and legitimately hoped to achieve that goal, and there is nothing in the statute that would belie that goal. There also is nothing in the statute that would inevitably endorse silent prayer in violation of the second prong of the Lemon Test. Contrary to the district court's interpretation, and as the other courts of appeals to address this issue have found, there is no endorsement from impermissible effect simply from a moment of silence law. It doesn't simply provide two alternatives. and teachers do not necessarily encourage prayer simply by holding this period of silence. I see that I'm running far into my time.
Do you acknowledge that there is a difference between, say, for example, the way the Virginia Code lays it out or the Texas Code lays it out, where these alternatives are, you know, individual choice, meditation, prayer, engage in any other silent activity in our statute? You acknowledge there is a difference?
Yes, there is a textual difference, but there is not an intentional difference. So that it is clear from the legislative history that the intent is the same for our statute. All of the sponsors said this is intended for students to reflect on whatever they wish. And it has never been interpreted to limit the students simply to those two options that are presented.
And do you agree that if any other silent activity were in the statute, we might not be here today?
That was contemplated during the pendency of this litigation. There was amendment contemplated, and I believe that plaintiffs had stated that they would not continue challenging if some of the language were changed. But our position is that there is no need to change the language because it's already in there that students can think about whatever they wish.
Thank you.
If I may have some time for rebuttal.
Yes, we asked you a number of questions, so I'll give you 2 minutes
Thank
extra.
You.
Mr. Grossman.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Grossman, representing plaintiffs here, Don Sherman and Robert Sherman, father and next friend. To be clear about this, there is nothing in the Constitution of the United States nor in any Supreme Court opinion ever decided by the United States Supreme Court that prohibits any student from praying before, during, or after school. And I'm not sure who said it first, but he's certainly correct when he says as long as they offer tests in school, there will be prayer in school. The fact is that even at the time of Wallace, that's 1985, the court there finds it constitutionally objectionable to change the words to or voluntary prayer because the right of the student to pray during school is already enshrined in our constitutional jurisprudence. There is no reason to add the words or voluntary prayer. That's what they said in Wallace. Now, I concede the pedagogical purpose which is advanced by the state here, which is that students should quiet down at the beginning of the school day. I don't think anybody in this litigation has ever challenged that. But if that's the secular purpose, then why doesn't the statute just say that? The fact that it doesn't is, in my opinion, and our opinion, the plaintiff's opinion, evidence that the legislative purpose was not, in fact, just to announce a moment of silence, but was to encourage and introduce the concept of prayer into the public schools. And, of course, we know that these are impressionable children, tender age. They're, as the Supreme Court has often said, their attendance is compulsory. They're impressionable. They tend to find the teacher to be an authority figure. And here you have a teacher encouraging the students to pray. Now,
let me, before you go on, what if the Illinois legislature had just copied the Georgia statute, which doesn't refer to prayer at all? Would that pass Establishment Clause muster?
I believe that that's what the district court said. I take your honor's referring to the Brown case.
Right.
And in Brown, they amended the statute to take out any reference to prayer. And the district court offered that as a perfect blueprint for how to get conceded pedagogical purpose of quieting the students down into the classroom. You just tell them that they have to be quiet. Why do you need to do anything else other than announce that there shall be a moment of silence?
Well, one of your arguments is that this alternative is just the two alternatives, is too focused and encourages, you know, prayer. What if the statute had prayer in the middle of a list of 20 silent options?
Well, you know, that's what happened in the other cases. But we say that, to answer your question, I believe that, you know, as in all of these Establishment Clause cases, it depends. It depends what else went on, the legislative history, its implementation, and so forth. But the question in those other two cases, I think it's Croft and Bone, B-O-W-N.
Right, Bone. That's the Georgia case.
They do provide catch-all phrases, or at least they give the impression that they're not just focusing on one of two compelled binary choices. Pray, and by the way, that's listed as first in this statute. You can either pray or you can do something else. And in those other statutes, what you have is you can silently meditate.
It's not really a fair reading of the statute. It says it's an opportunity to do those things. It doesn't say you have to do either one.
Well, you know, the district court found that the only reasonable way to comply with the mandate of the statute.
That's not a finding of fact that binds us, though. I mean, in the procedural posture of this case.
That's
a supposition of the district court.
Your Honor is suggesting that the word opportunity somehow dispels the compulsory nature of the only two offered choices. And
well, it bothers me. I mean, the words are in the statute, see, and I've got to do something with them.
Yes. Okay. So you have the word opportunity, but the fact is, if they had said, for instance, or included but not limited to, or some other type of phrase that gives them an some other choice. But here you have an opportunity to. If I say to you, you have the opportunity to walk out of the room, or to do something else, it means you've got one of two choices. And I insist that the statutory language, counsel for the appellant says, well, there's nothing in the statute that would encourage prayer and just without any kind of evidence whatsoever. The fact is, this is a statute which says two things. You can either pray or do something else.
Which is my next question. Counsel for the appellant did indicate in her presentation that the reason prayer is mentioned in Section 1 is to clarify that is a permissible thing to do during the moment of silence. It might not otherwise be apparent, among other reasons, given the constraints of the Establishment Clause. In other words, the legislature felt it needed to say explicitly, you can pray privately, you can't do it publicly, which is a plausible reading of the statute taken as a whole. What's your reply to that, sir?
The Supreme Court has invalidated numerous times the proffered secular purpose in these cases. The state in Stone versus Graham said, we're going to post the Ten Commandments. And the court said, that's even though the state professed that the secular purpose there was to encourage moral rectitude or whatever, they rejected it and said it's an attempt to introduce prayer into the schoolroom.
Yeah, but it had mandates, it had public funding, it had lots of things that went into that that the 5-4 decision could go on either way. I think what we're trying to focus on here is can't a legislature genuinely attempt to accommodate, to follow the law by doing this? It seems to me if someone wants to structure something in and to make it sufficiently secular, but nevertheless to at least acknowledge or accommodate without endorsing, it seems that this is the effort. Now, are you okay with the Croft language?
I suggested in my brief that we did not find the distinction compelling, but it was not risible, so I didn't. It wasn't laughable. It wasn't, in other words, the distinction there was that
we had four options.
Mm-hmm. Right, so you had four options, but they said that the word prayer is simply a minor and not too important accommodation.
Well, it depends who's reading it, I guess.
Right, in all of these cases, but what I'm saying is that.
No, I mean reading the statute. Look, people can take different things out of it. Just like when we say, may God save this, the United States, this honorable court. Some can say that's rote repetition. Others say think it means something. So I think it's, isn't that what they're trying to do here is to accommodate the law without rupturing it.
It's a slippery slope from accommodation to endorsement, and I would suggest to you that in Wallace, which is the closest analog here, the court said even adding just the words or voluntary prayer was bespake a legislative intent to endorse religion.
But they went back to the guy, the sponsor, just saying outright, we're trying to put prayer back in school, and they made a big deal out of that.
They did, but they also said that there was no secular purpose that was not already served by the statute that they had in place.
But
and
the concurrences especially went on and on about, yeah, but, and it could be this, and that's okay, and you take a lot of the phrases out of there, and you're saying, gee, where are we? We knew where we were with Wallace, and that is the sponsor said, we're trying to get prayer back in school.
Yes, but they also found that it was an important element that there was no secular purpose that was not already served by what was either in the court's own opinions or in the law that existed. The same is true here.
Well, let me ask you this again. I want to know on this, if the language had been just as it is, but it was added or engage in any other silent activity, do you think that would pass constitutional muster?
The plaintiff's belief is no, but I have the Bone case and the Croft case to deal with, and
right.
Your brethren in those circuits have decided that that's okay. I'm suggesting that it conflicts with my understanding of what Supreme Court precedent.
So you would say that even the Croft case and the Brown case don't. I mean, should have been. Those cases were wrongly decided.
We'd like to have seen them decided differently, but I would concede that in those cases, that the argument that's been made and the rulings that have been made are not so off the mark as to be unacceptable. See, my time is up.
Well, hold on. Let me see if there are any other questions. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Grossman. Mr. Schwartz?
May it please the Court, I'm Adam Schwartz for the ACLU amicus. By this Court's leave, I would like to direct my remarks towards the religious effect of this law. I want to emphasize the second half of the second sentence, that the moment, quote, shall be an opportunity for silent prayer or for silent reflection. And we've heard before about the absence of words like including that would suggest this is a choice. I want to emphasize that it says shall. It doesn't say this may be an opportunity. It says it shall be an opportunity. And when the teachers are implementing this act, where they're going to look to figure out how to implement the act is the face of the act itself. We've heard from counsel for the state that had the act only said there is no religious exercise, that the students might have been confused and thought that the there was a prohibition on prayer. So this assumes what is reality in this case, which is that the teachers are going to tell the students how to use this moment, and they're going to look to the act. Now, when a student is told by their teacher...
I'm sorry. I'm interrupting, but I guess it's good. Your view is that that is the inevitable. That's going to happen. That's your premise. The teachers will explain it to the students.
We have two alternative premises. The best and, we believe, only natural reading of the law is the teacher will say to every student, it is now time for you to pray or to reflect upon the upcoming day. In the alternative, if you do not believe that, at a minimum, this act is an authorization and an encouragement to every single teacher to do so. And so whether or not there are some teachers and some schools who are not saying this to their students, every single teacher and every single school is being told that they may and indeed should do this.
You'd have to admit that the act doesn't tell the teacher to tell the students that, does it?
What the act says is that it shall be an opportunity for prayer or reflection.
Yeah, but that's why you're complaining it's vague, because it doesn't tell.
The ACLU is not asserting vagueness,
not.
And as
okay.
far as the vagueness goes,
okay,
I don't
I'm
think
sorry.
It goes
I,
to...
I know. I didn't distinguish who is which. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
they're the vague guys, right?
Okay. Yes. A critical question is what response students will have to to being told by their teacher, now is the time for you to pray or reflect. For the youngest children, a kindergartner, a kid who's 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, when their teacher says, it is time for you to pray or reflect, they will not know the meaning of the word reflect. So they will not understand that pray or reflect is a choice. They will interpret this as an instruction to pray. And because they are young and want to please their teachers, they will tend to pray. This isn't just common sense. This is the testimony of the expert in this case submitted by the plaintiff, Dr. Louis Krauss, the chief of adolescent and child psychiatry at the Rush Hospital here in Chicago. As to the junior high school students, we know from Santa Fe versus Doe, we know from Lee versus Weissman, we know from our own common sense, and again from the expert report of Dr. Krauss, that these children are very susceptible to peer pressure and other subtle coercive effects. And when these students are, if these students see that most of their peers are praying, what they will do is tend to pray as well. I want to address the issue in the concurrences that were raised earlier in the Wallace versus Jeffrey case, the opinions of Justice O'Connor and Justice Powell. What they say is for the moment to be proper, it is necessary that every student be left to his or her own thoughts. That manifestly is not what is going on in Illinois. When you say to a student you can pray, or you can engage in this very narrow, very archaic secular alternative of reflection upon the anticipated activities of the day, the student is not left to his or her own thoughts. He cannot think about tomorrow or yesterday. He cannot read or write. He cannot imagine things or baseball or any other activity. And this is what makes the Illinois statute fundamentally unlike all of these other statutes.
So you think the other statutes, the one in Virginia and Texas and the Brown and Croft case, meet constitutional muster?
There are two ways this court could go in striking down the Illinois statute. The preferred course by the ACLU is to hold that as soon as there is a prayer option, it tends to encourage children to pray and ought to be struck down.
Even though in these cases, you know, prayer is not the first alternative.
The fact that it is first tends to further show an endorsement, but it's not necessary that it be first. And so we believe at the ACLU that Croft and Brown were incorrectly decided. But if this court does not accept that, it easily can hold that even though Brown and Croft were correctly decided, the Illinois Act is fundamentally different, where the Virginia and Texas say to the kids you can pray or engage in any other silent activity. Illinois is saying you can pray or you can reflect upon the anticipated activities of the day, but don't think about anything else. And I want to emphasize there are 30 states other than Illinois with moments of silence. 17 don't have a prayer option at all. 4 of them, including Texas and Virginia, say other than prayer, you can think about any other activity. 5 of them say other than prayer, you can simply meditate or reflect without limitation. 3 of them are discretionary and not mandatory like Illinois. Other than Illinois, there is one other state, Kansas, with a mandatory moment of silence that says, kids, you have to pray, and if you don't want to pray, we've got this one narrow, archaic, unattractive option for you, which is reflection upon the anticipated activities of the day. I want to briefly address...
Why is that an archaic option?
It's archaic in the sense that I don't know what teacher would find it useful to say to a student, if you're going to think about one thing, it's going to be upon the anticipated activities of the day, as opposed to what your long-range goals are or what someone has done for you that is nice.
Why it is more compatible with the idea of calming the students, stopping the music, stopping the chatter, focusing people on what's going to happen the rest of the day in school, right? And that's what the counsel for the appellant tells us this is all about.
I have 3 responses. First, we are skeptical that silence is a particularly effective way of calming the children and getting them ready for the day.
Well, that's you against the legislature. Right?
I understand that. But number 2, even if we assume that silence somehow is this calming effect, there is no additional calming effect by saying to the kids, what you're going to do while you're silent is either pray or do something else. And number 3, to the extent that giving them instructions about what to think about is going to have this calming effect, there is no reason to pick of all the things under the sun the upcoming day. But we don't have to assume that it's archaic or strange. It is narrow. And again, by narrowing so restrictively the secular option, it tends to channel children towards prayer. I'd like to briefly address the denominational preference argument. The two critical facts about this case are, number one, on the face of this act, there is a religious criterion, which is whether or not the faith tradition that a student brings to school has a form of prayer, which is silent and still and brief, as opposed to active and spoken and lengthy. And it sorts all religions into winners and losers on the basis of this criterion. The state, number two, concedes in summary judgment proceedings below that there are religious traditions that cannot be accommodated during this brief period in terms of accomplishing their prayer.
I mean, there are religions, I guess, or religious beliefs that do not include silent prayer.
Correct. Silent, brief, and still prayer. This is conceded by the district court. This is acknowledged, for example, by Judge Michael McConnell in a law review article.
Would you say conceded by the district court?
I apologize. It's conceded by Superintendent Koch in the summary judgment proceedings below. He says that some students will have their prayer accommodated and some students will not have their prayer accommodated by the brief, still, silent moment of silence. So this case is very much like Larson versus Valente, where you have a religious criterion, in that case whether most of the money comes from co-religionists or from outsiders, that has the effect of sorting all religions into winners and losers without naming which religions are the winners and losers. Even if this court accepts the state's version of the standard review, which would be rationality review as opposed to the strict scrutiny set forth in Larson versus Valente, there is no rational reason to have this prayer option stacked on top of the moment of silence. Because, whatever pedagogical value there is to silence, that silence is not made more pedagogically valuable by limiting what the kids can think about to just prayer or these other activities.
Well, the silence, of course, is the overall secular purpose. And some, you for one, don't think that works, but it doesn't matter. But that seems to be, silence is where they start. That's where they put their foundation. Then they add to that. And you didn't think... I think you said it correctly. You don't think religion should be any option, and I think that's at least a fair way to say it for your point of view. But if you have a series of things that could be thought about, it's in silence. And I guess what you're worried about with religion is some people can't pray quietly, so they got to go on to the next thing, which is think about the rest of the day, which is archaic. I don't know where the big problem is where somebody happens to have a religion that they can't pray silently.
The problem with that is that children are told that their religion is abnormal when they are told by their teacher every day, what you can do now is pray, and if you aren't a kid who can pray silently and briefly, don't pray. But all you other kids who are in here who can pray briefly and silently, go ahead and pray. We think it is stigmatizing and it endorses the majority of religions that can make that use of the moment of silence.
Can you speak, just changing topics for a minute, to the interplay between Section 5 of the 2002 amendment to Section 1, we're dealing with now, the 2007?
If Illinois had done what Georgia did, we would not be here today. If Illinois had made this mandatory and simultaneously taken out the prayer option, what they would have left is Section 5, which is virtually identical to similar language in the Georgia statute. And so the teachers would say, kids, be silent. And that is all the teachers would say. And you would have this backstop of Section 5 guaranteeing to all children in Illinois, if any guarantee was needed, because we already have the free exercise clause in a number of federal statutes, but a further guarantee was needed of the individual right to pray. And incidentally, the ACLU, of course, believes that every child, during appropriate moments of silence, should be allowed to pray. And if someone tried to stop them, that would be a violation of their rights.
So under that scenario, could the teacher then say, this is the time to be silent, and you understand that everybody has a right to pray if they wish, consistent with Section 5? I mean, how would the student know that they would have that opportunity to pray if all the teacher could say is be silent?
I think that the best course would be for the teacher to say, be silent. And if there was some student who believed that he was not supposed to pray during this moment of silence, the student could raise their hand and say, am I allowed to pray? And the teacher would say, yes, you may, because the teacher would be aware of Section 5. But that is worlds apart from on a daily basis saying to the kids, it is now your time to pray or to reflect. And when you force that choice upon children every single day, it tends to encourage prayer, especially for the youngest children who cannot, who do not have the intellectual capacity yet to distinguish prayer from reflection, whatever that means to them.
Can the student just say, "We'll now have a moment of silence"?
Can the student say?
No, the teacher, I'm sorry. Can the teacher just simply say, "Okay, calm down, we'll now have our moment of silence"?
If we put...
Is she in violation of the statute? That's all she says.
If we put legislative purpose aside and implementation aside, and we're just talking about whether the text of a moment of silence statute has a per se religious effect, the position of the ACLU is that a mandate to teachers to say, "Kids, be silent," is not a violation of the Establishment Clause. And again, that is what we have in Georgia.
Could the teacher in Illinois say that and be in compliance with the state statute?
We believe the answer to that is no. We believe that the state statute is a
mandate. Does your case depend on that?
It does not, because even if it is not the mandate that we say it is, it is at a minimum an authorization and an encouragement to every single teacher in Illinois to say to their kids, "Kids, it is time for you to pray or reflect." And therefore, even if some teachers and school districts are not doing so, it is in every application and on its face has a predominant religious effect.
Suppose, hypothetically, you lose this case. And suppose school district 597.1, someplace out prairie here, puts out a circular and tells the teacher, "All teachers in this district will, in fact, say the following to the students. We're going to have a moment of silence. During that moment of silence, you can do two things, but only one of those two things. One, you can pray. Two, you can reflect on the day's events to come. We'll now have our moment of silence." Would you be free to bring an as-applied action with respect to that directive?
Yes.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwartz, and Ms. Murphy will give you an additional 2 minutes.
Ms. Murphy, may I ask your response to the question I just asked counsel for the ACLU amicus? Would an as-applied action be permissible under the circumstances I hypothesized?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's exactly the point that I wanted to emphasize on rebuttal, that we are dealing here with a facial challenge to the statute. They have to show that there are no circumstances under which Section 1 would be constitutional. And the court should read the statute to be constitutional to the greatest extent possible. And there is no unconstitutional aspect about the text itself. The entire argument of appellees rests on this idea that the teachers will tell students they may either pray or reflect on the day's activities, and that's all you can do. But here, in fact, District 214, the named plaintiff's district, announced simply, "We will now have a brief period of silence." They waited 15 seconds, and they moved to the pledge. That is a situation in which even counsel has admitted that is not an unconstitutional encouragement to prayer.
I know your time is short, but you have not really gotten into one matter raised by counsel for the appellee, and that is Justice O'Connor's concern about creating ins and outs by the operation of the statute. Could you respond at least briefly to that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Are you meaning the distinction between those who practice silent prayer and those
That's
who
correct.
Do not? Yes. The statute does not invidiously discriminate against those who do not practice silent prayer, because it all comes down to a legitimate need, a secular need, for silence. Every other court of appeals that has addressed this issue, including the Third Circuit in May, has rejected the argument that by imposing silence, you are discriminating against some religions that do not practice silent prayer. The statute is about a moment of silence, and the legislature could legitimately believe that by allowing audible activities, their whole purpose of calming students down would not be met. And so, as this court recently stated in Nelson, where there is a legitimate secular need and a statute is not discriminatory on its face, as in Larson, then that is enough to justify any incidental differences among religious practices.
Let me ask you this. One of the points counsel made is about the order of the choices here, that praying is first. In these other statutes that we have, it comes second or third down the line.
That's not relevant, Your Honor, in terms of just because prayer is listed first doesn't mean that's the one that should be emphasized or encouraged. They've never responded to our point made in our briefs that if lifting prayer first here meant that it was encouraged, then statutes like the Equal Access Act, which lists religious speech as the first of types of speech that are protected, would somehow be endorsing religious speech. But the Supreme Court has not held that. There's no reason to believe here that by listing it first, it's being preferred. In fact, it makes sense, again, to list prayer first to immediately rebut the preceding phrase, or not rebut, but to rebut any negative connotation from the immediately preceding phrase, which states that the moment shall not be conducted as a religious exercise. So it makes sense to then immediately say, but you can silently pray, because those two go together. Anything else?
Thank you,
Your Honors. We ask that you reverse.
Thank you. The court will take the case under advisement, and we will call.